Ever found yourself drowning in a sea of medical research papers, wondering how to separate genuine insights from flawed studies? You're not alone. When Dr. Tricia Greenhall first published How to Read a Paper in 1996, evidence-based medicine was still an emerging concept. Today, it's the cornerstone of modern healthcare practice. This transformative guide, now in its seventh edition with co-author Paul Dykstra, has been translated into over 20 languages and adopted by medical schools worldwide. Bill Gates even cited it as one of his essential reads for understanding healthcare innovation. What began as a simple handbook for students has evolved into the definitive resource for anyone who needs to navigate the complex world of medical literature, whether you're a physician making treatment decisions, a researcher designing studies, or a patient trying to understand your healthcare options. Evidence-based medicine, EBM, represents a fundamental shift in healthcare thinking, moving from "I think this works" to "the evidence shows this works." At its core, EBM is about applying mathematical estimates of risk and benefit derived from high-quality population research to inform individual clinical decisions. This approach combines clinical expertise with systematic research, patient values, and individual circumstances to make more informed healthcare decisions. The need for evidence-based approaches becomes clear when we examine problematic decision-making patterns. Anecdotal reasoning, where clinicians rely on personal experiences rather than collective data, can perpetuate ineffective or harmful practices. For instance, bloodletting persisted for centuries based on individual practitioners' beliefs in its effectiveness. The press-cutting approach, changing practice based on a single study without critical appraisal, leads to whiplash-inducing practice changes, as seen in the frequent reversals of dietary recommendations. Perhaps most concerning is the GOBSAT method, good old boys sat around a table, where experts perpetuate practices based on tradition rather than evidence, such as the historical resistance to hand-washing in medical settings. History is littered with examples of treatments that experts strongly endorsed but later proved harmful. For decades, babies were placed on their stomachs to sleep until evidence revealed this position increased sudden infant death risk, leading to the successful back-to-sleep campaign. Antiarrhythmic drugs were routinely prescribed after heart attacks until research showed they actually increased mortality by 20 to 30%. Hormone replacement therapy was widely recommended for preventing heart disease in postmenopausal women until large trials demonstrated increased risks. These examples underscore why systematically evaluating evidence matters. Navigating the vast medical literature presents significant challenges. Healthcare professionals face barriers including lack of time, estimated at less than 1 hour per week for reading, limited search skills, and information overload. The medical literature has grown exponentially. Medline alone contains over 29 million references, with approximately 2,000 to 4,000 new citations added daily, creating what many call the information jungle. The challenge is compounded by varying study quality and the presence of conflicting results. Different search purposes require different strategies. Informal browsing to stay current might involve electronic journals, medical news sites, and social networking platforms like Twitter's medical communities. Finding answers to specific clinical questions benefits from synthesized information sources like systematic reviews, clinical guidelines, and evidence-based summaries like UpToDate or DynaMed. Comprehensive literature surveying for research projects demands systematic searching across multiple databases, including Medline, Embase, and the Cochrane Library, often with professional librarian assistance. Evidence exists in hierarchical levels, though modern interpretations have evolved beyond simple pyramids. Traditional evidence pyramids place systematic reviews and meta-analyses at the top, followed by randomized controlled trials, observational studies, and case studies, with expert opinion near the bottom. However, contemporary approaches recognize that different research questions require different study designs. For instance, rare disease research may rely more heavily on case studies, while public health interventions often require cluster randomized trials. Understanding this hierarchy helps clinicians prioritize which evidence deserves greater weight in decision-making while recognizing the value of multiple evidence types in different contexts. When approaching a research paper, three fundamental questions help orient yourself. Why was the study needed? What research design was used? Was that design appropriate for the question? These questions form the foundation for critical analysis and help readers understand both the context and potential limitations of the research. Research designs vary significantly in their ability to answer different questions, each with distinct strengths and weaknesses. Randomized controlled trials, RCTs, where participants are randomly allocated to different interventions, are often considered the gold standard for evaluating treatments. They minimize selection bias and confounding factors through randomization and controlled conditions. However, they have notable limitations. They're expensive, may introduce hidden biases through strict inclusion criteria, and their results may have limited applicability to real-world populations. For example, an RCT testing a new diabetes medication might exclude elderly patients with multiple conditions, despite this being a common patient profile in practice. Cohort studies follow groups with different exposures over time to see who develops specific outcomes. Sir Richard Dahl's landmark 50-year study of British doctors established the smoking lung cancer link by tracking mortality rates among smokers and non-smokers, a finding that would have been impossible to establish through an RCT. Modern cohort studies have evolved dramatically with electronic record linkage, often involving hundreds of thousands of participants tracked over decades. The Framingham Heart Study, for instance, has followed multiple generations since 1948, providing crucial insights into cardiovascular disease risk factors. Case control studies identify patients with a particular condition and match them with similar individuals without the condition, then collect data on past exposures. These studies primarily investigate disease causation rather than treatment efficacy. They're particularly valuable for studying rare conditions or diseases with long latency periods. The challenges include precisely defining cases, selecting appropriate controls, and establishing causation due to recall bias. A classic example is the study that linked rare vaginal cancers in young women to their mother's use of diethylstilbestrol during pregnancy. Cross-sectional surveys collect data at a single time point from a representative sample. They're ideal for determining normal ranges, like a child's height, measuring healthcare professionals' beliefs, or establishing disease prevalence in communities. The National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, NHANES, exemplifies this approach, providing crucial population-level health data that informs public health policy. Case reports describe individual patients' medical histories, often compiled into case series. Though traditionally considered weak evidence, they provide rich information that might be lost in clinical trials, can be published rapidly, and serve as valuable learning units for healthcare professionals. The first identification of AIDS and the recognition of thalidomide's teratogenic effects both emerged from case reports. The traditional hierarchy of evidence ranks study types from strongest to weakest. Systematic reviews and meta-analyses, definitive RCTs, non-definitive RCTs, cohort studies, case control studies, cross-sectional surveys, and case reports. However, this hierarchy shouldn't be applied mechanically. A methodologically flawed meta-analysis shouldn't outrank a well-designed cohort study. The grade system, grading of recommendations, assessment, development, and evaluation, offers a more nuanced approach to evaluating evidence quality, considering factors like study limitations, inconsistency, indirectness, imprecision, and publication bias. When evaluating a paper's methodological strength, five essential questions determine whether to reject it outright, interpret its findings cautiously, or trust it completely. This systematic approach to critical appraisal ensures that clinical decisions are based on reliable evidence. First, was the study original? While most research incrementally advances existing knowledge rather than breaking entirely new ground, it should contribute meaningfully. This can occur through larger sample sizes that increase statistical power, improved methodology that reduces bias, different study populations that expand generalizability, or addressing clinically important questions where uncertainty persists. For instance, a study might examine a common drug in a new patient population or combine existing treatments in novel ways that better reflect real-world practice. Second, who is the study about? Research participants often differ substantially from real-life patients in illness severity, demographics, lifestyle factors, comorbidities, and health behaviors. Particularly concerning is the persistent underrepresentation of older adults, women, racial minorities, and those with multiple chronic conditions in clinical trials. This creates significant evidence gaps for treating these populations and raises questions about external validity. For example, a drug trial excluding patients over 75 or those with kidney disease may have limited applicability in primary care settings where such patients are common. Third, was the design sensible? Critical appraisal is largely common sense despite its forbidding terminology. Focus on whether the outcome matters to patients, like survival, quality of life, or functional status, rather than surrogate endpoints, like laboratory values or imaging findings. For symptomatic, functional, psychological, or social effects, look for evidence that outcome measures were objectively validated using established tools and scales. The study design should match the research question, randomized trials for interventions, cohort studies for prognosis, and case control studies for rare outcomes. Fourth, was bias avoided or minimized? Bias systematically influences conclusions about groups and distorts comparisons. Regardless of study design, compared groups should be as similar as possible, except for the specific difference being examined. Key types of bias include selection bias, differences in how participants are recruited, performance bias, unequal treatment of groups, detection bias, systematic differences in outcome assessment, and attrition bias, differential loss to follow-up. Even with rigorous control groups, assessment bias occurs when evaluators know patients' group allocation. Physical examinations and diagnostic test interpretations are far from objective. Doctors tend to find what they expect, highlighting the importance of blinding. Fifth, were preliminary statistical questions addressed? Three crucial statistical considerations determine a study's validity: sample size, ensuring the study has sufficient power to detect clinically significant effects; duration of follow-up, allowing adequate time for interventions to demonstrate their effects; and completeness of follow-up, analyzing data on an intention-to-treat basis, including all participants originally allocated to each arm, regardless of withdrawal or protocol violations. Studies should report power calculations, justify their follow-up period, and account for missing data appropriately. After reviewing a paper's methods section, you should be able to succinctly summarize the study type, participant numbers and characteristics, interventions, follow-up period, outcome measures, and statistical tests used. This foundation makes the results easier to understand and interpret within the context of clinical practice. Consider creating a structured checklist covering these key methodological elements to standardize your critical appraisal process. In today's healthcare environment that increasingly relies on mathematics, clinicians cannot afford to delegate statistical evaluation entirely to experts. Even those who consider themselves enumerate need basic statistical literacy to understand which tests are appropriate for common questions, what these tests actually do, and when they become invalid. This fundamental understanding has become crucial as medical literature increasingly emphasizes evidence-based practice and quantitative analysis. Non-statisticians can evaluate statistical tests by understanding basic principles rather than memorizing formulas. Critical evaluation requires awareness of common tricks of the trade that researchers might employ to manipulate statistical results, including cherry-picking significant p-values from multiple comparisons, failing to adjust for baseline differences between groups, ignoring data distribution requirements, excluding study withdrawals without proper justification, confusing correlation with causation in observational studies, selectively handling outliers to achieve desired results, and performing unplanned subgroup analyses after seeing the data. Numbers in research represent different types of data that require appropriate handling methods: nominal data, like gender, ordinal data, like pain scales, interval data, like temperature, and ratio data, like blood pressure, each demand specific analytical approaches. Statistical tests are classified as parametric, assuming data follows specific distributions like normal, or non-parametric, making fewer assumptions about distribution. The shape of data distribution matters greatly. Normal distributions form symmetrical bell curves, while skewed distributions show asymmetry, affecting test selection and result interpretation. Retrospective subgroup analysis, data dredging, represents a serious form of research manipulation. If researchers analyze data long enough, examining multiple subgroups, they'll eventually find some category of participants who appear to have done particularly well or badly purely by chance. This data dredging bias can lead to false conclusions with real consequences, as demonstrated when aspirin was wrongly withheld from women for years after a spurious subgroup analysis suggested it only prevented strokes in men. Modern statistical practices require pre-specification of subgroup analyses to prevent such errors. P-values, while commonly misunderstood, represent the probability that a particular outcome would arise by chance if no real difference existed. Scientific convention deems P less than 0.05 statistically significant, and P less than 0.01 highly significant. This arbitrary threshold means 1 in 20 significant findings will be false positives by definition. A significant peak in LU suggests rejecting the null hypothesis, while non-significant results could indicate either no real difference exists or the sample was too small to detect one, type 2 error. Confidence intervals provide more informative estimates than p-values alone by showing the range within which the real difference likely lies. A 95% confidence interval means there's a 95% chance the true population difference falls between those limits. Larger trials naturally produce narrower confidence intervals and more definitive results. For example, a blood pressure reduction of 10 millimeters with a 95% CI of 8 to 12 millimeters provides more certainty than one of 2 to 18 millimeters. Statistical significance often means little to patients who want to know their actual chances of benefit. Using the coronary bypass versus medical therapy example, detailed calculations show patients on medical therapy had a 30.5% chance of death at 10 years compared to 26.4% with surgery. This yields a relative risk of 87%, relative risk reduction of 13%, and absolute risk reduction of 4.1%. The number needed to treat is 24, meaning 24 patients would need surgery to prevent one death. These practical measures help translate statistical significance into clinically meaningful information for decision-making. Understanding both relative and absolute risk helps contextualize research findings for real-world application. Applying evidence with patients requires carefully balancing population-level data with individual needs. While evidence-based healthcare relies heavily on population averages from clinical trials, individuals rarely conform exactly to these statistical means. Some patients may be more susceptible to benefits or more vulnerable to harms from interventions based on their unique genetic makeup, comorbidities, lifestyle factors, and personal circumstances. Sackett's original definition of evidence-based medicine deliberately incorporated three key elements: research evidence, patient preferences, and clinical judgment. This tripartite model recognizes that the best treatment isn't necessarily the one showing highest efficacy in clinical trials, but rather the one that optimally aligns with a patient's values, preferences, life circumstances, and ability to adhere to treatment. For example, a medication requiring 4 times daily dosing may be more effective in trials, but less suitable for a busy professional than a slightly less effective once daily alternative. Patient-reported outcome measures, PROMs, have emerged as crucial tools for capturing patients' perspectives on how disease and treatment affect their quality of life. These self-completed questionnaires assess domains like physical functioning, pain levels, emotional well-being, and social participation. Unlike traditional clinical measures like blood pressure or lab values, PROMs reflect what matters most to patients in their daily lives. Common examples include the SF-36 health survey and disease-specific measures like the WOMAC index for arthritis. Shared decision-making, which gained prominence in the late 1990s, fundamentally shifted the paradigm by viewing patients as rational agents capable of meaningfully participating in treatment deliberations. Good decision aids make complex evidence accessible to non-experts through visual representations like icon arrays, color-coded diagrams, and natural frequency formats to convey risk estimates. For instance, showing that 5 in 100 people experience this side effect is more intuitive than stating 5% risk. Option grids were developed to address the practical barriers to shared decision-making in time-constrained clinical settings. These one-page tables present treatment options as columns, with rows answering frequently asked patient questions like, "What does it involve?" "What are the side effects?" and "How will it affect my daily life?" Their streamlined format promotes efficient option talk while supporting both patient reflection and meaningful dialogue with clinicians. N-of-1 trials offer an innovative, personalized approach where individual patients serve as their own control, receiving both intervention and control treatments in random order over multiple cycles. In these single-patient experiments, treatments are anonymized and labeled simply as A or B to minimize placebo effects. While theoretically elegant for identifying individual treatment responses, especially in chronic conditions with stable symptoms, N-of-1 trials haven't achieved widespread adoption due to practical challenges in implementation and analysis. However, they remain valuable in selected cases where individual response variation is high or treatment effects are unclear. We stand at the cusp of an AI revolution in healthcare, with research exploding at a dizzying rate. AI applications now span the entire healthcare spectrum, from preventive care to acute interventions. These include sophisticated risk prediction models that can forecast patient outcomes with increasing accuracy, intelligent note-taking systems that reduce administrative burden, advanced clinical decision support tools that analyze complex patient data in real time, automated image interpretation for radiology and pathology, diagnostic algorithms that can identify rare conditions, personalized treatment recommendation engines, and natural language processing systems that enhance patient-doctor communication. Despite their impressive capabilities, machines remain fundamentally different from human healthcare providers. They lack the nuanced understanding of human suffering, the ability to provide emotional support, and the capacity for genuine empathy, all crucial elements of medical care. Therefore, AI applications should be positioned as powerful tools to augment and support healthcare professionals rather than replace them. The WHO's 6 key principles for ethical AI in healthcare provide a crucial framework: protecting human autonomy in medical decision-making, promoting patient well-being and safety through rigorous testing, ensuring algorithmic transparency and explainability, fostering clear lines of accountability when AI systems are deployed, ensuring inclusive development that addresses diverse populations, and promoting AI systems that are both responsive to healthcare needs and environmentally sustainable. Mechanistic evidence has emerged as a crucial complement to traditional evidence-based approaches, offering detailed explanations of how interventions work at multiple levels. The Cochrane Review of School Feeding Programs illustrates this perfectly. Mechanistic investigation revealed complex chains of causation that statistical evidence alone couldn't capture. Beyond simple nutritional intake, success depended on biological factors like lactose tolerance, cultural acceptance of food choices, and complex family dynamics where school feeding sometimes led to reduced food allocation at home. This deeper understanding of mechanisms has profound implications for program design and implementation across healthcare interventions. Consensus exercises have evolved into sophisticated methodologies for managing expert disagreement and uncertainty. These include structured approaches like Delphi panels, nominal group techniques, and consensus development conferences. They're particularly valuable in emerging fields where traditional evidence is limited or conflicting, helping to establish standardized definitions, disease classifications, outcome measures, and clinical guidelines. These methods also play a crucial role in research priority setting, healthcare resource allocation decisions, and policy development, providing more systematic and transparent ways to harness collective expertise. The philosophical limitations of evidence-based healthcare have become more apparent as the approach has matured. While standardization through clinical guidelines can improve care quality, it can also create rigid frameworks that don't adequately account for individual patient circumstances or clinical complexity. Guidelines, once established, often persist beyond their evidence base and can be slow to incorporate new findings. The proliferation of guidelines, sometimes contradictory, has created a paradox where the tools meant to simplify clinical decision-making have instead added layers of complexity. The relationship between evidence and policy has proven particularly challenging. The aspiration to make policymaking fully evidence-based often oversimplifies the inherently political nature of healthcare decision-making. Policy decisions inevitably involve trade-offs between competing values and priorities that can't be resolved through evidence alone. What appears as technical debate about evidence often masks deeper disagreements about social values, resource allocation, and healthcare priorities. Reading medical papers critically isn't just an academic exercise. It's essential for providing optimal patient care. By understanding research design, methodological quality, statistical analysis, and practical application, clinicians can distinguish reliable evidence from flawed studies. This skill becomes particularly crucial when evaluating new treatments, diagnostic tests, or clinical guidelines that could directly impact patient outcomes. The critical appraisal process involves several key competencies: evaluating study design appropriateness, assessing potential biases, examining statistical methods, and determining clinical relevance. For instance, when reviewing a randomized controlled trial, readers must consider factors like randomization methods, blinding procedures, follow-up completeness, and whether the studied population matches their own patients. The skills developed through critical appraisal extend beyond evaluating individual papers. They enable healthcare professionals to synthesize diverse evidence sources, recognize when consensus is needed, and balance population-level data with individual patient needs. This might involve weighing conflicting results from multiple studies, understanding meta-analyses, or determining how observational data complements randomized trial evidence. Practical application requires considering both internal validity, the study's methodological rigor, and external validity, its applicability to real-world settings. For example, a perfectly designed trial conducted in a specialized academic center may not translate directly to community practice. Similarly, studies with strict inclusion criteria may not represent the complex, multimorbid patients often seen in clinical practice. As medicine continues to evolve with new technologies like AI and gene-based therapies, the fundamental principles of evidence assessment remain constant, examining methodology, questioning assumptions, considering context, and focusing on patient-relevant outcomes. Modern challenges include evaluating machine learning algorithms, understanding omics data, and assessing real-world evidence from large healthcare databases. The journey from evidence to practice is rarely straightforward. It requires navigating the information jungle, critically appraising research quality, understanding statistical nuances, and applying findings in ways that respect both scientific evidence and patient values. This might mean considering subgroup analyses for specific patient populations, evaluating cost-effectiveness data, or incorporating patient preferences into decision-making. By mastering these critical reading skills, healthcare professionals can better distinguish between truly practice-changing evidence and less reliable findings. This expertise allows them to fulfill the true promise of evidence-based medicine, providing care that is both scientifically sound and individually appropriate, while avoiding the pitfalls of accepting research findings at face value or implementing changes without proper evaluation.